Well, I hope, Levi, got you feeling a little boisterous tonight because I want you to do something when the offering bag passes you by. 60% of you are like Sherry and myself, and you give electronically. So the bag moment is, it can be empty unless you're able, like we do, to celebrate. You know, we already literally have been generous back to God and His work. One of the things we teach the kids in the Players Box, which is a new ministry we started to help students really deal with pressure, the pressure of performance in arts, athletics, and academics, is Amy Cuddy is a psychologist who came up with this, and she said that the research shows that the Wonder Woman pose, as she calls it, actually sends energy to the brain. So when you get up in the morning and you look at yourself in the mirror and you do this, we call it the Superman pose too for obvious reasons, it literally activates your brain for action. So tonight we're going to be talking about the soul, your soul. And really smart people, every action of their life now is so integrated into bringing the kingdom of the heavens into their life through Jesus that every action now is leveraged to growing our soul. So one of the things we teach the kids when we teach this is a lobster, when it's feeling powerful, its body literally gets bigger. And when a lobster is feeling dominated, it literally shrinks. And so I just want you to do a little bit of a lobster Wonder Woman Superman pose when the bag goes by. And if you've given, I want you to just feel your soul increase, okay? Everybody ready to do that? If you haven't given, why haven't you? Why haven't we want you to be a part of it. So right now, the bag's being passed. This is not just an empty financial exchange. This is an action that Jesus says will grow your soul. So if you're the 60% have already given, just kind of do one of these when it goes by. Just feel your soul expanding. If you're being generous right now, just, you know, put something in the bag and then just let your soul expand, because this is an action that can grow your soul. That's exactly right. This action of generosity is something that makes our souls larger. And by the end of this night, I think you're going to see why that is absolutely critical. How many of you were here last weekend? Raise your hand. How many of you, it was 10 minutes in before you realized I was not standing up here. I was not actually here. I was in Florida at this time last week doing a wedding at Cinderella's Castle in Disney. But I do want to say something here. The reason, you know, once or twice a year I pull the video card because there's just a message I feel like I need to give. And the reason for this one is last weekend, if you were not here, was peace versus war. And the one thing that is supposed to set Christ followers apart from the rest of the world, our ability to resolve conflict, our ability to forgive, our intention to never just walk away from relationships because they're hard. That one thing, I do believe in my experience, is the one thing that we're typically in the church no different from the world. We're just no different. We're just no different. Our ability to resolve conflict. And last weekend I shared what was a life-changing relationship for me was when a dear friend of mine years ago were in intense disagreement. And we both had learned that our tendency was to just say, you know what, I'm cutting my losses. I don't have time or energy for this. And we worked it out, and today we are like brothers. And that taught me that this ministry of what the scriptures call reconciliation that we have now been given because we have been reconciled to God is the number one factor that will separate you from the people you live with, work with, live beside, etc., is the ability to say, I'm not cutting my losses anymore and moving on. I'm gonna do my part to work it out. So if you did not hear that last week, and I talked about the three things that really everything that Randy teaches on, everything that Gary Sweeten teaches on, really elaborates on this: start with your heart, restrain your brain, and cool your fool. Those three things, if you can get those, you're on your way to being a person who doesn't just walk away from conflict, that you learn to work it out. But today we're talking about the soul. And most of us are aware of the fact that sin is the enemy of our soul. How many would you agree with that? Like, sin, yeah, sin's bad. Sin is bad, and it's the enemy of my soul. Yeah, but few of us would be aware that another enemy of our soul is speed. Another enemy of the soul. Your soul grows in direct reverse proportion to the speed of your life, which today we are faster than ever. There is a writer by the name of Letty Kalman who talked about a traveler going through Florida, doing a tour. I'm sorry, not Florida, Africa. I've got Florida on the brain. Africa, Sahara, sub-Saharan Africa. And she engaged in a group of carriers and guides, hoping to make her trip, her journey through sub-Saharan Africa in the bush as efficient as possible so she could experience as much as possible, not miss out on anything. And she was pleased with the first day of their journey and the miles they covered and the expanse of land that they got to experience. But on the second day, all of her guides and carriers at the beginning of the day refused to move, Letty Kalman said. They wouldn't budge. And the traveler was frustrated by that, and she asked the leader of her hired hands why they would not continue the journey. He told her that on the first day they had, quote, traveled too far, too fast. And now they were waiting for their souls to catch up to their bodies. Now they were waiting for their souls to catch up to their bodies. What is your soul? In church, we talk a lot about our soul. Why so downcast, O my soul? The Lord is my shepherd. You restore my soul. Lift up your soul to the heavens. When we talk about the soul, what are we talking about? Dallas Willard describes the soul this way, this immaterial part of you. This immaterial part of you. The soul is your capacity to integrate all the parts of yourself into a single whole life. Your soul is something like a program that runs a computer, and you don't usually notice it unless it commits an error. That's a good way to put it. Our soul is that integrating part of us. The way I see it, and this may not be accurate, but my understanding of the soul is really these four realities: energy, engagement, emotion, and eternity. Our soul is that part of us that is our, we would call it today, our life energy. The New Testament calls the dunamis, the dynamic of our spiritual being. So when someone's, you know, when we say someone has a great soul, a lot of times we're talking about that energy part of the soul that just gives life, right? Our soul is also this engagement part of us. It is the interface that allows us to connect to God and other people. And so when our souls are healthy, we're able to connect with God. We're able to connect with other people. Our soul is also our heart, our emotion, another E, our emotion. And when our souls are healthy, we have a healthy manifestation of, a healthy awareness of our emotions, the things that are bringing us joy and laughter and such. And then our soul is that eternal part of us. It is utterly immaterial. It is the reality of your being that cannot be weighed. It cannot be quantified, but it is eternal in its reality. And your soul is that which operates in integrating your mind and your body. It integrates your whole being into oneness. Jesus said, seek first God's rule in your life, and it will integrate your life. This idea of lifting up your soul to the heavens will begin to integrate all of your being into one reality. The soul, your soul, is constantly seeking out harmony and connection and integration. We talk about integrity a lot. Integrity is a soul word. Integrity means all of my parts are integrated into one focus, one being. And so the soul that is lost is disintegrated. There are parts of you that seek this, and there are parts of you that seek this. There are parts of you that hide from this. There are parts of you that expose yourself to this, but there's no integration, and that's the lost soul. It's in different parts. Willard goes on to say that what matters then is not the accomplishments you achieve. What matters is the person you become. And when he says that word, the person you become, he's talking about the soul. Listen to me. If your soul is healthy and growing, nothing outside your soul can destroy your soul. Nothing. If your soul is not healthy, nothing outside your soul can make it happy. Nothing. No one. And this is real important because many of us, we still live as if it is other people's responsibility to carve out a soul-satisfying existence for us. And I want you, as you listen into this tonight, Tengang, as we talk about the care and the growth of your soul, there is only one person responsible for your soul. Who is that person? It is you. You are responsible for carving out a life that grows your soul, that grows that part of you that is energy and life, that is engaging with God and others, that has healthy expression and channeling of emotion, and that is eternal in its scope. It is your job. So every once in a while I do some of these narrative messages that are just as simple gets. Stupid is as stupid does, the great philosopher Forrest Gump said. And so this tonight is about as simple as it can get. But here's one question that our Savior asked. That is the only question I want you to think about this week. Mark 8, he looked at people not unlike us, and he asked the question, what does it profit a person if they gain the whole world and they forfeit their soul? Now, the typical way to understand that, a lot of people interpret that as, what good is it to make money and go to hell in the end? It's like the typical binary Western linear thinking way of looking at that. It has nothing to do with that. That verse actually has nothing to do with hell. It's not talking about your destination. It's talking about your diagnosis. What is the pursuit of everything this world has to offer costing your soul? At what cost to your energy, engagement, emotion, eternal self, are you gaining the stuff that this world has to offer? This is not a destination verse. This is a diagnostic verse. Because as many of us know, if we don't even believe what Jesus says, like we don't really believe in Jesus yet. And on any given weekend around here, we have a number of you who are just, you're here because someone invited you, a spouse dragged you here, and you're not even sure you believe this. But when you look at Mark 8:36, when you look at that and you don't even believe in Jesus, and yet you look around you at the world in which you live, is it not true that there are a lot of people who are gaining in the stuff this world has to offer, but there's something of the self being forfeited? There's something that's getting lost in all of that? Let me walk through 7 scenarios and see if one of these hits you. There's a businessman who commits his whole life to building a financial empire. His children always knew they were lower on his priorities than his job, even though that's never what he said, ever. Kids know. And they did. Our true devotions are inadvertently expressed by what we give our heart to. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Where we give our emotions, where we give our engagements, where we give our energies, that's where we're giving our soul. Right? What we laugh about, what we cry about, what moves our emotions, that's what has our soul. And this man's soul is given to a financially prosperous corporate empire, and his employees are just cogs in the machine. They don't feel valued. They're just parts in an ever-churning machine. And he and his wife, they have it all. They bought an incredible home overlooking a beach in South Carolina. And one day he had a stroke. And no one comes to visit him. He sits alone in a wheelchair, breathing from an oxygen tank, isolated in his prison by the beach. And while he's doing that, in his mind, he is still obsessing over how much he is financially worth. There is very little of his soul left. Or maybe you know someone who's that mom who overfunctions to create the perfect home. She does everything. Her husband doesn't help very much, but even if he did, what he did would not really help because it would not be good enough. She doesn't mention how much she resents his lack of help because she knows that would lead to conflict, and conflict would burst the bubble of their perceived perfect family. She's angry toward her children for not being perfect, for not being academically successful enough to get into the right schools, for not making her look good as a mom. She's angry with her body for aging. Feeling attractive has been one of the unforced sense of worth in her life, and it is slowly disappearing from her, and she knows it. She isolates herself. She drinks a little too much. One of her guilty pleasures is she gossips about friends with friends. And above all, she never stops moving. Because to stop moving would be to hear her soul crying out for life and nourishment, and she doesn't want to hear that. As long as she doesn't hear her soul cry out, she can believe her problem is her husband, her kids, her age. But it's none of those. It's her soul. Her soul is dying. Or what about the guy who finished college and plunged into building a life? He got married. He had children. He got a job as a financial analyst for a highly regarded investment firm. He monitored the financial movements of the world, the currencies of life. He had monitors that kept him in touch with every time zone, every hour of the day. His cell was on 24 hours a day, always being alert for an opportunity that might come and go. And he and his boss shared this indefatigable passion to win. They're often sleeping on cots in their offices so they can pull the trigger on deals in a flash. He got more money in his Christmas bonus this year than his dad made in his entire life. His kids have gone to private schools. His wife has taken care of the day stuff with them as life. His life was fueled by adrenaline and caffeine with a pace that had no place for the growth of his soul. And if he would have stopped, he would have heard this. I am your soul. And I'm dying. I'm dying. Or let's look at this impressive young lady in eighth grade algebra class. She's sitting next to a boy who is smarter than she is. During tests, she sneaks a look at his paper. Not enough to get caught, you understand. Just once or twice, but enough to move her up half a grade. Now, she doesn't think about whether or not she deserves this grade or if what she's doing is actually fair to other students. If she gets the good grade, she'll be happier and her parents will be happier and her parents will be proud of her. And she tells herself that because she really did study and because most of the questions she does answer on her own, so it's not really cheating, and she's done it before anyway. The same eighth grader is playing in the finals of a tennis tournament, and she comes to the net and her opponent hits a lob over her head. When it hits the court, she calls it out, even though it was not out. There's an umpire at the net who does not initiate calls, but is available to arbitrate if there's a disagreement. And her opponent trusts her, and she doesn't question this girl's call. The umpire, whom she knows, looks at her after the point, and she wonders to herself, does he know? Does he know that it really was in? And I called it out. She feels queasy and she can't tell if it's because she cheated or because she thinks he knows. She thinks she would have felt better if she had cheated and no one would have noticed. She thinks about how she would feel worse if everyone knew, not that just the call was wrong, but that she called it wrong deliberately. Oh well, she thinks to herself, her mother and father have achieved so much in life. She does not feel like she can compete with that. She has to cheat to measure up. She's never been the pretty one or the smart one or the talented one in the family. She was just one in the family. She's now married. But her marriage brings her little pleasure. Her husband is as committed to his career as he is passive at home. She wants to scream at him sometimes because almost anything would be better than his shallowness and his silence. She tried to become a teacher, but she wasn't very good at it. She tried to become a writer, but every rejection from every publisher was just too painful to risk submission again. And she works at a job she's not challenged by, and it feels like dirt is being thrown over her grave every day. Her two daughters struggle with not being liked by boys and not having the right bodies. When she sees other parents at school or at church who look and act successful and happy, parents for whom life seems to come easy, she is angry with them, with herself, and with God. She looks forward to her three glasses of wine every night so she can get some relief from this knot in her gut. And she expects life to get no better. And her soul is shrinking. Or what about, do you know the guy who was in high school and who was a great football player? He was all league, he was all district, he was all everything at his school. But he blew out a knee in junior college, which was not where he really expected he'd be playing college football anyway. He dropped out. He got married and had a child. He never made a decision to reject God. Never. He just drifted. His pace in life was not fast by any stretch. His pace was simply without intention and direction. And in his soul weakened condition, it was easier to drink beer than to work on his marriage, so he got a divorce. It was easier to complain than to work with all his soul, so he lost his job. It was easier to avoid people who would challenge him to care for his soul and grow his soul, so he just hung out with people who never challenged him, who encouraged his life of comfort and his life of freedom above all else to do whatever you wanted to do. Predictably, he lives with his son now, the son with whom he was estranged for many years, the son with whom he now lives because there's no place else for him to go. He watches porn in his bedroom to pass the time. He has lost his health. He is waiting to die. And when he does, the truth is, no one will really mourn his death. They will mourn his life. The life that was wasted. The life in which a soul was allowed to die a long time ago. Or maybe you know that couple. That couple who believes they can have it all. They don't see why they have to make choices when, because of their innate talents and their training and their connections, they can have it all. They can have the business success and the bodies and the bank accounts and the beach house and the bustle and the hustle. And they're committed Christians too. And they give of their time and their treasure and their talents to their church because that's part of having it all. What no one knows is they fight over the most meaningless, trivial issues every night. And their therapist has advised this couple that they need to give up some things. They can't have it all. Their therapist advises them, you need to go home earlier every evening and spend time together. And they're both thinking the same thing. Does the therapist not understand? Why would we want more time to fight? But the therapist says something. You have nothing left for each other. You give each other the leftovers. There's no energy. There's no engagement. There's no emotion. There's no eternal stuff left. So you have no capacity to look past your partner's annoying idiosyncrasies. You're tired. And so you're likely to interpret an action from your spouse in a negative light. You're tired, so you're likely to project your insecurities onto them. And you just have no soul left to pour into your relationship because you give it all at the office, at the club, at the church. What does it profit a person to gain the whole world and forfeit their soul? Jesus asked. Is that still a relevant question today? You better believe it is. Because every day there is this potential to give parts of your soul away, and you're never doing anything to replenish, to restore your soul. You're not living a life that restores the soul and grows the soul. One of my favorite television shows of all time was Everybody Loves Raymond. It's one of those flip stoppers, like when you're flipping through the TV and you see Everybody Loves Raymond's on, and you've seen that episode 11 times, you stop and you just got to watch it again because it is so funny. Ray Romano was 29 years old. He was still living with his parents. He was a struggling stand-up comedian. And years later, when he recorded the final episode of Everybody Loves Raymond, he came out to the studio audience. And he opened up a note that his older brother Richard had given him. He said his older brother had given him this note on the first day of filming of Everybody Loves Raymond. And on this last night, I think 11 years later, 7 years later, however long the show ran, he read this note to the studio audience. It was one question. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? This is the question, Southbrook, that every once in a while we have got to stop and ask ourselves. Because one of the easiest things to do is you get to flowing with this world's pace and this world's priorities and this world's passions. And one day you wake up and there's nothing left of the good stuff. And you know why? It's because there are just very few places in this world that'll stop and say, hey, are you investing in what matters most? I mean, very seldom. Advertising doesn't do that. When's the last time you saw an ad that said, hey, stop and consider your soul? No, it's about don't get on that elevator with dandruff. Don't do that. Buy our shampoo. It's what matters most, right? Yeah. Many of the conversations we hold do not. The stars we follow do not. The entertainments we consume do not. The resumes we pass around do not. And God waits to allow Him to redeem, restore, and renew our souls. The part of us that makes us human. The part of us that is made in His image. For He is energy, He is engagement, He is emotion, and He is eternal. And He waits and He waits for us to realize that if you get to the end of your life, and you didn't prioritize the soul, you gain nothing. Because everything else is sandcastle. So, he came to show us what a life with a healthy soul looks like. He did, didn't he? He came to show us, here's what a human being with robust energy, engagement, emotion, and eternity looks like. This soul is so healthy. It is so strong. Nothing outside of that soul could destroy it, not even a cross. Right? This soul was so healthy, nothing outside that could touch that soul. That soul, in its moment of intense trial, forgave his executioners. This is the ultimate soul, isn't it? That can say, I choose a cross because that is the agency of redemption for those I love. And on that cross, I will show what a soul looks like in full bloom. I will forgive those who are torturing me. It's just, I mean, I'm not there yet. Are you? Let me just be real simple here. Here's what he did. He prayed. He had huge chunks of margin he set aside for solitude. That's what he did. If you want to be what he was, you have to do what he did. And one of the things he did is he prioritized quiet with his Heavenly Father. I've told you before, when Mark 1:35 says that he went alone to a quiet place where he prayed, I've actually climbed that. It's mountainous. To get to where he went to pray was a 2-hour climb to get away from everyone. Now, how important was that for him? And we actually, in our climb, they put handrails in there now where they embedded into the rock so that you can climb it easier. He didn't have that. How important was that to grow his soul that he was alone? Nobody can do that for me. I have to carve that out. And it's tough. What else did he do? Look at this. He fed his mind with Scripture. This guy just allowed the Scriptures to wash over him. And if you would have pricked him, out would have come Scriptures that he was feeding on, feeding his soul, feeding his mind, the words of God. Look at what else he did. This is something else he did. He invested in a network of life-giving people that integrated service and support in such a way, it wasn't done out of obligation, but enjoyment and mission. He had a close circle of friends, the 12 who journeyed through life with him, with whom he shared everything. And above everything, they were his friends. This is real important, that he arranged for his life to be around people that he liked and that he could invest in, and they in him. This is so big. Energy-giving people through whom my soul flows and their soul flows into me. He prioritized regular community worship at synagogue. Many people don't realize this. Jesus was what we would call a regular church attender. He went to the synagogue, as was his custom. There's something that he knew that happens to the soul when you come together with people who are going in a like direction and say, my soul rejoices in you, God. There's something going on here. The way the psalmist put it is he inhabits the praises of his people. There's something that happens in the collective that doesn't happen in isolation. He didn't call people to church attendance, but he was a church attender. Here's a big one. He enjoyed God's creation, mountains and gardens and lakes. He took long walks. He fished and he golfed. Well, he would have. But I mean, this is a big one. Every day we wake up with this enormous panorama of God's action. The heavens declare the glory of God. Right? It's a little tougher to see on days like today, I understand. But think about that. He welcomed little children, hugged them and blessed them, and he volunteered in Southbrook Kids. Now, I'm telling you, friends, this was an underestimated part of his life. Was there something about kids who bring, they grow your soul. They annoy your soul sometimes, but this was big. There's something so reciprocal in how he embraced children that other people saw as annoyances. This was just a regular thing with him. It says so much about him. What else did he do? He enjoyed going to parties with non-religious types. Now, some of you are doing this one real well, okay? He was so frequent at social gatherings of fun that his critics said of him, "Here's a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of sinners and immoral people." The point being here that Jesus wasn't just a, you know, sour, dour, religious clergyman who just, his spirituality was reflected in his sour demeanor. No, this was a man that people loved to be around, and he loved to be around these environments where it was just fun. And I think that grew his soul. Look at this next one. He carved out a soul-growing, soul-satisfying life. Because there was only one person responsible for Jesus to carve that out. Who was it? It was Jesus. And there is only one person responsible for this happening in your life. It is you. It is not the responsibility of your wife, your husband, your children, your parents, your teachers, your coaches. It is your job to carve that out, to grow a life that grows your soul. He restores my soul, the psalmist said. And I'll tell you, Southbrook, and just as simple as I can make this, that's what he did. And that's what I plan on keeping doing. People ask me about what's my life like, and pretty much, that's my life right there. That's pretty much it. And that's what I plan on keeping on doing. So far, God has grown my soul. Does anybody want to join me in that journey? I want you to, this week, really think this through. Go on Instagram, go on Facebook, go on our website, whatever you have to do, but these will be posted. Number one, during the message, I shared 7 different stories. Which story did you most identify and why? Which one you said, "Oh my gosh, that was me"? Number two, your soul is the place of energy, engagement with God and people, healthy emotion, and eternal connection. On that basis, how's your soul? If your soul is healthy, nothing outside can destroy your inside. If your soul is unhealthy, nothing outside can satisfy your inside. On that basis, how's your soul? Where are you getting regular input and teaching on what matters most, on what matters forever? Because if you are not intentional about that, you will be dragged into things that do not grow the soul. What parts of Jesus' soul-satisfying, soul-growing life are you not modeling? And what is stopping you? Because tonight, friend, is the night where you put that in reverse and you begin doing the things that you have to do to carve out a soul-satisfying, soul-growing life, because it will not profit you to gain everything this world has to offer and forfeit your soul. Let's pray. So, Father, here we are at another gathering, another engagement. This hour was very possibly very, very profitable for our souls because we gave our energies to this hour. We engaged our being. We allowed our emotion to be moved. We opened our hearts. We tapped into that eternal part of us. Or it was not. Because the world has so captured our soul that we can't stop. Now, I think I know you enough to know that you will do whatever you have to do to get the attention of our soul. You love us. Flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of the heavens. It is our soul. Because spirit speaks to spirit, soul to soul. You know, 20 times in Scripture we are told of your soul, Father. You are energy and engagement and emotion and eternity. May this hour have profited our souls.